you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Brent was kind enough to help me get set up here. And Brent, let's consider ourselves going, and I'll keep letting people in as we go here. But Brent also was someone that was kind enough to pop up a question on the subreddit, and it's something that I actually wanted an excuse to talk about, which is the iPhone lineup. So Brent, go ahead and hit me with your question, and let's start talking about iPhones.
So it's kind of three pretty random trends, but one of them is iPhone thickness, and this is more of an observation. I don't necessarily expect you to have any answers, but we hit the point where it was down to 6.9 millimeters with the iPhone 6, and that was bend gauge, right? And most of those gates are the kind of thing where you expect it to just kind of go away. It's not really that big of a deal. People are stress testing it. They find these limitations that make a big deal out of it, and then it goes away. But you saw Apple over the next four generations of iPhone increase the thickness all the way up to 8.3 with the XR and the 11.
And so what was the thinnest that they ever achieved? Or which version was the thinnest?
The 6 was 6.9 millimeters.
Huh.
And then they increased it a little bit every generation up to the XR, and then the 11 were both at 8.3. And now with the 12, we're back down to 7.4. And I understand there's the design change from the rounded sides to straight sides. And so it feels larger than it does because of the flat sides. But I feel like at some point, Apple was admitting like, oh yeah, we did make these things too thin and it was a bit of a problem.
I don't know that that's it, because we know that the reason is when they change the screens, like they need more battery. And we know, because they've told us multiple times that, you know, the 5G modem is a huge power suck. I mean, that's why we're anticipating that you're going to get less of a battery life from these phones anyway. But it's so funny that you said that, because you know, you do the trade-in, right? So I had a good 72 hours with both phones that you could put in your hand. I have the 12 Max, and I know that it's slightly bigger, but it was noticeably heavier. And like that's my tipping off, or my launching off point to talk about this, is like this is starting to approach like more than I want in terms of size in my pocket, and like this is starting to feel like a serious brick. I don't know if that's going along to your question. I don't know that I want a thinner phone though. Like I do like the design better. It feels better in the hand. It doesn't feel like a soap bar that, you know, will just slip right out or anything. But I don't know. What are your impressions? I'm assuming you have a new one.
Well, I just ordered the Max last night. So, okay. Or this morning, I guess, very early, but, yeah. And the thing I'm thinking about is like iFixit teardowns are not revealing some sort of internal, structure that's going to keep these things from bending, and like the physics aren't really changing. Like,
yeah,
are they just, I'm just wondering, like, are they running towards the problem that they had before that they seem to admit that was a problem and they made it thicker? But yeah, I mean, the weight is an issue. Like, as you said, like it is heavier, and I think the stainless steel perhaps gives it a little more structure, but
now see, I'm hedging on it's maybe getting to be too heavy or too big to me. At the same time, I'm more satisfied with this. This feels more substantial, like it's rugged, right? And that's actually what I wanted to talk about is, so I'm one of those people that does an upgrade every 2 years, and I always upgrade, like, you know, if I never got the 10, I got the 10S, right? because whatever they introduce in that first year, I wait for the second iteration of it for whatever reason. I don't know, but because it's not like these things are ever horribly bad. Like the worst we ever got was, you know, you're holding it wrong, right? But that what that allows me to have the sensation of is that, you know, when I go from, when I have this 2-year jump, like every time, so how many iPhones would that mean that I've had in my life? What is that? 6-ish maybe? Right. 6. So thank you for the fingers there. This is the first time that I've done an upgrade where it's like, oh, that is a noticeable difference. And I'm saying even the, when I did the, went up to the 10S. So that's the first time that I got portrait mode. That's the first time that I got the modern versions of the cameras. And my my leap in photography was so significant that I was like, okay, this is the first time where I'm like, I really can't tell the difference in my day-to-day usage between my old phone and my new phone. And because it feels substantial to me, and because it's got 5G, I'm saying that I think that this is the first time where this might be a phone that'll last me 4 years. The only thing, because, and this is what we did the story on today, is you saw that upgrade. They're saying, well, the upgrade next year, and this is super early to be speculating about this stuff. Oh, you're just going to get a slightly better third camera, right? And I'm sure Apple will say all sorts of great things that you can do with that camera, but that won't be enough for me or for anybody. Like the only thing, like, does anyone know, is it, we don't have the millimeter wave on any of these, right? So if that becomes more ubiquitous, maybe to get the better 5G, I would maybe want to upgrade. But I just can't see any. I'm literally, we've been saying it for decades, peak phone, there's nothing more they can do to these. I really think that I would have this thing for 4 years and not care. And that's the first time I've felt that way.
The 12s do support millimeter wave, okay. US only though.
Right, that's right. I did that. See, it's funny. I remember now that I said that. I can't remember what I say from day to day. So yeah, what do you think about the idea that maybe peak phone has finally arrived? I can't think of anything substantial that they could give me that would be like, oh, I'm gonna miss. I have FOMO. What do you think they could possibly do that would make you think FOMO within 2 years?
I mean, honestly, I was on the 2-year cycle until the 7, and the year that it came out, my first son had just been born a month ahead of time, and I just, like, everything was crazy and I just didn't even bother upgrading. And so I'm upgrading from the 7 this year. So, and the 7's been fine.
Yeah.
This whole time.
I mean, and that's enough of a leap that you would certainly notice a huge difference. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel faster. And I know that the photographs I've taken so far look better. But again, it's not like the jump to portrait that was so significant, you know?
I'm curious about this because Apple never mentioned it as far as the lens. Mm-hmm. On the Pro Max, the wide camera, the 26 millimeter camera, has the larger sensor. But what they didn't mention is what that means is the lens itself is different. Now, the lens has the same 7-element design, and it has the same 1.6 aperture. But the lens itself, to get that same 26 millimeter perspective, mm-hmm. the lens itself has to be larger than it is on the 12 Pro. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what that's going to actually come out in day-to-day as far as like vignetting on the lens, sharpness around the edges. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that stuff you can sort of correct in software. So I don't necessarily think you're going to see a huge difference out of the stock camera app. So I'm curious to see, like, Austin Mann's review will probably be out next week.
Yeah.
The Halide review will be out at some point. So I'm curious to see what the difference is in the lens, because the lens itself has to be different. And Apple's not talking about it like it's different. They're listing the same specs, but it could potentially, there could be some factors there other than the larger sensor.
By the way, just to jump in, because like I'm trying to parse like the depth of this conversation, because it's interesting. On the one hand, you know, they're always going to make more Porsches and BMWs, and there's be, you know, little angles that maybe are a little bit more interesting or fashionable and will get bell bottoms again, and et cetera and so forth. So there's, on the one hand, there's just kind of recycling, you know, side, like there's only so many things you can do with a Swirkle, you know, and those shapes. My question, and maybe it's more interesting to me, is I think, you know, in the 4 years that it'll take for you to upgrade again, Brian, what is it that the phone has become? Because at least with this iteration, what is interesting is the direction of bringing charging, you know, like the phone itself becomes a hub for your other devices. And so that's true for AirPods. That's true for maybe the watch. And so what other, that'll be true for the, whatever their tiles are going to be called. And what is the point of those tiles, right? Like, I feel like, yes, like Tile exists as a separate company and as a product to like find the things that you might lose. But I feel like Apple has to have a much bigger, more interesting consumer play where there's a story about, you know, having things in your environment or something, and that the phone interacts with those things from an augmented reality perspective. And while yes, like making static photos or live photos with a better camera is sort of interesting, LiDAR and 5G mean that you interact with the world through your phone and through your device and through like the glasses eventually in a way that is different than it is today. So I feel like we could keep talking about how the phones have been used for the last 10 years and presume that things are just going to, you know, persist, just like we've had cars for the last 100 years. And so we'll just presume that cars will be the same for the next 100 years. But I feel like that's not the way that this is actually going to go.
By the way, people on the Zoom call can see that that's Chris Messina, but we didn't introduce you, Chris. So, but see, that's why you're Chris Messina, because you're thinking of product in a much more sophisticated way than I ever do. Okay, so you've already talked me into it. The argument that you're making is that they're...
You may have bought the last phone of the phone generation
exactly.
of phones.
So you're saying that... didn't we talk about this once about how this goes back to the whole Steve Jobs idea of a hub for all of your devices that used to be the Mac and now it's the phone? And you're saying that they're positioning... What'll get me to upgrade in 2 years is if it's, you know, the charging connected to
maybe it's battery, maybe it's storage, maybe it's speed of transfer. It's like, so the reason why I bring this up, and for at least the people who are here, I'm going to share a blog post that I wrote where I named the iPad before it was named, and it was November 5th 2007.
Oh, there you go.
Anyways, the reason why I bring this up is more the way that I was thinking about the iPad, right? So imagine designing the iPad before the iPad exists. That's what I tried to do with this post. And basically I said, let's get rid of a bunch of assumptions about what computers are and move a bunch of the hardware, i.e. the mouse and the keyboard, into the software, which is basically what happened. And it was sort of like, let's take the phone form factor and stretch it out a little bit. And so I'm trying to imagine a similar transition that we are about to go through, where macOS starts to dissipate in a kind of iOS-ified, like, concept. The iPad is the bridge between those two worlds. And so 4 to 5 years from now in the future, we're dealing with and interacting with the operating systems in a very different way, where maybe we're interacting with the world in a more, where computing basically is in everything around us, as opposed to going through this device and then getting sucked into it.
Right. And the LiDAR, as people have hinted at, despite my sort of poo-pooing it, like that's leading us in that direction where, yes, okay, a potential FOMO for me is if there is real utility for doing serious AR in the real world, and that LiDAR sensor is the first step in that.
Well, because so the other reason why I bring this up is because of the way in which identity plays a role in what you just described as like the phone being the hub. Mm-hmm. The phone is kind of what you authenticate into. And that gives you access to all of your sort of rundles across all of your Apple services and entertainment and so on. And so if you carry that device and it's constantly, exactly, like as Peter said, app clips, basically you're streaming everything around you in partial components of functionality. So if I want an Uber, I just kind of ask Siri to get me a ride. And there's a bidding process that happens where there's a bunch of service providers. And then I get the app clip when the car arrives and I do the Apple payments. And then I get in and I go, and it all happens sort of seamlessly. But as opposed to the concept now where in order to use some software, I have to download it first, and then I have to set up an account and just go through all that ritualistic process, I feel like what Apple is moving towards, and I've said this with regards to, you know, if Apple comes out with its own search engine, we shouldn't assume that the Apple search engine would be like Google. essentially what the Apple search engine would be more like the App Store, where it's an authenticated environment where every website you go to essentially can know who you are, potentially, if you want, using Apple sign-in, and you get instant personalization for all of that stuff. The social stuff, obviously, Apple doesn't really care that much about. That's not really their game. But I do think that an authenticated, secure environment is the future that they want to provide people. And all transactions sort of happen within that computing paradigm.
Peter, I unmuted you. Jump in here.
Yeah, so I think Chris did service to the AppClips comment, but I also have this feeling that society and phone users are starting to recognize the value, the daily value of having the best iPhone. So
say more about that. What is
the more ecosystem, the bigger the ecosystem, AppClips, the new MagSafe stuff, NFC, actually, I think there are two NFC readers on the phone, the latest iPhone. iPhones cost about $1 or $2 per day to have the best iPhone and upgrading like every year, every other year. So I think it's possible that people will be willing to spend $1 or $2 per day when they already spend $4 a day on coffee.
And Chris is right to make the point, to come back to the sort of reductive way I was looking at it initially, was that, you know, Apple's MO is not to like telegraph the thing that, especially a year out, that would make me have FOMO. Because whatever that thing is, like, they've been developing it for 6 years and they'll bring it out when the time is right. And so he's right to say that, you know, it's often when, you know, they get accused of not being able to innovate my ass, you know, like that sort of thing. That's because they're holding their fire until they can they don't just do like unnamed other companies do, where it's bam, new feature as soon as we can do it. Bam, new feature as soon as we can do it, without any sort of overall. Chris is right to say they think, and Peter, they think of the overall ecosystem in a holistic way. And so whatever that next, if Chris is right that this is the last phone, whatever the next thing that an iPhone is going to be beyond just a phone, they're not going to bring it out until they can bring out 5 or 6 bells and whistles at once, instead of just, okay, here's the next iterative feature.
And I think night mode photography is a really good example of that.
See, like, I haven't played around with that enough yet. Go ahead.
Everyone, Google was ahead on the night mode stuff, but it didn't quite have that natural feeling. And to think that Apple hadn't been working on it up to that point is nonsense. Like, they were absolutely working on it and they just weren't happy with it until last year. And now that they have it, they're continuing. The software isn't enough, so they're continuing to push their hardware so that they can make their night mode software better. And it's that complete package. It's the integrated design that Apple is known for. But the software isn't enough. But they use the software to great effect.
So two other things that I would add to this. One is, what is the significance of Apple Silicon over time? For the phone, for the iPads, and so forth. Like, what does it allow them to do in terms of size, heat, efficiency, security? What was the thing you just said? You're talking about night mode. Oh, and then I was going to say, and what is the sort of long-term consequence of Apple's privacy stance towards its ability to create better machine learning models that actually can rival, let's say, what Google does, right? So Google's night mode would be so good because they train it on everyone's Google Photos. Apple ostensibly can't do that. I don't know what training sets they use or that they get, but I would imagine that it's harder for them to do some things, especially search, if they restrict themselves from accessing information. So those are two other things that I would add into this or ask about. Like, what does Apple Silicon do for them in terms of unblocking stuff? And then what is their AI ambitions? How is that impacted by their approach to data privacy?
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort.
Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. It's warm out today, so I'm wearing one of the polos I got from Mack Weldon when I stocked up for the spring. I could wear this to my son's soccer practice, but I'm also wearing it to an investor meetup in the city tonight. That's because Mack Weldon apparel looks like regular clothes, but feels like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. This polo I'm wearing is an upgrade on the classic polo with antimicrobial silver thread. It feels great. From their light as air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code RIDE. At work or at home, we all know one person who's password challenged. Sticky note reminders, emailing passwords, reusing passwords, using the word password as a password. Is this you, maybe? Because data breaches affect everyone, you need 1Password. 1Password combines industry-leading security with award-winning design to bring private, secure, and user-friendly password management to everyone. Companies lose hours every day just from employees forgetting and resetting passwords. A single data breach costs millions of dollars, but 1Password secures every sign-in to save you time and money. Any device, anytime. 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else. Your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. 1Password generates as many strong, unique passwords as you need and securely stores them in an encrypted vault that only you have access to. I've been a 1Password fanatic years before they became a sponsor. I can't imagine my life without them. That's no hyperbole. Join me, won't you, right now. My listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/ride. That's 2 weeks free at 1Password.com/ride. 1Password.com/ride.
Can I, Peter, I want to, we'll stay on phones, but we'll jump over because in the chat you had asked about Google phones and the Pixels, and was it you that asked last time if we so what do you think based on what we've seen now from the Pixels this year?
So I think it was kind of obvious that this is the way it was going. The Pixel 4 was not really that much better than the Pixel 3, and it seems like Google has either given up on the high end or has just given up on being a tastemaker in phones, or at least trying to compete with Apple. So I'm wondering what you all think, if they're just tailoring off, or if this is their new spot in the market.
This is another one where Chris would be closer to knowing people who would know the answer to that. My more outsider-y take is that, yeah, it's totally obvious that the main and one overriding reason for Chris, I'll unmute you in a second. The overriding reason for the Pixel was to essentially shame the entire Android ecosystem into being good, right? Now, you don't have to do that by making a $1,500 phone necessarily. You don't always have to knock it out of the park. But if you're not going to produce a phone that says this is the best of what Android can be, then what are you doing? Because, you know, okay, someone says somewhere that, okay, we need to have volume sales, otherwise we can't justify this entire project. But you're not going to, I mean, you can get volume by producing the best $600 phone, but is that really going to move the needle enough to justify all of the research that they're doing to try to make the best Android phones possible? I don't know. Chris, what do you think? Without, you know, naming names or anything, do you think this is just a case of another one of like Google's going to get bored of it and they're done?
Well, again, I think this has to me, the way I think about it is like, are we talking about phones or are we talking about essentially a flagship into a relationship that somebody
I'm full stop talking about Google still doing hardware for anything, you know?
But I'm saying something a little bit different, which is it is not clear to me, and I don't know the economics of it, that the economics of producing a phone are as expensive as it used to be. Mm. So in other words, like maybe it was costly before for Google to basically put out sort of like a best in breed phone. And it was very important for them to lead the industry to establish a beachhead for Android to basically say, okay, the phones don't suck. The, you know, the software doesn't suck. Like it's actually usable. Right. So maybe that mission has been accomplished, you know, not in the George Bush sense, but in actually kind of like getting like Google services out there. And it's like, yes, it's good. And so it's less important about the phones, because as we were just talking about, it's sort of, you know, whittling away and putting bell bottoms on the thing. And it's like, okay, it's just coming around in stylistic terms. What I think is interesting is to think about the subscriptions that we're going to pay to each of these companies and whether or not that sort of, there's enough value in those subscriptions, right? And it's interesting, one more thing, if you, so the Google said the Pixel 5 is the most current phone. If you actually Google for iPhone 12 or Pixel 5, the ads that come up are very interesting. So Apple owns all the iPhone ads at the top, but for the Pixel 5, it's like the carriers. It's like Verizon and AT&T, and I don't even know what Visible is, but I presume that's, I don't know what that is. But point being that these devices are a means to get into a subscription relationship with some other company. Right. And Apple wants to own that relationship. And what's interesting about Google and what they're doing with Google Fi is that Google is also providing the connectivity. And I don't know exactly how that plays out for Apple.
So essentially what you're saying, in the same way that it doesn't make sense to anybody but the players for everyone to have a play in smart speaker, for everyone to have a play in smart screen, for everyone to have a play in the home security, except for the fact that, coming back to what you said at the very beginning, this is all connected completely, where if you're getting into, we've talked forever about you ecosystem lock-in, but essentially what we're talking about is lifestyle lock-in.
I think so, but it's exactly that we are finally getting to the point where the Panzer tanks, you know, metaphorically, are sort of in position and the battle lines are being drawn. And we're actually now seeing what it looks like for Monopoly players to start really like competing and fighting on a different set of battles. Like, again, this idea that the phone is this precious idea that we need to keep thinking of as a phone, I think is missing the point where these companies are, which is 4 to 5 years in the future. And they're building in an assumption about building a relationship with a person from cradle to grave, and of course from children on, that you will have a relationship with one of those companies and you will pass down the hardware and you'll just have a relationship with them eternally. Like, it would be hard enough for me to like exit the Apple ecosystem now, but if, like, you know, you have young kids and you give them an Android device, they may learn all of the mechanics of the Android operating system such that they can actually easily switch in the future. And all of their photos are stored with Google and right. Like, even though, sorry, just to add this in, even the fact that I think Facebook has been advertising either on your show or other shows about how they're like sponsoring and working on data portability. It's almost like it's like too late. It doesn't matter. Like, you can get your data out, you can't take it anywhere. But even then, it's like, our relationships are so deeply wound into some of these companies for a large number of people that moving doesn't really even make sense. So I feel like that lock-in has happened. And so for Google, the phone is like a necessary piece to have. It's sort of like a steering wheel in a car, but it's not the car.
Mm-hmm. So they'll never completely do away with it, right?
Exactly.
And then that's sort of also the argument for what people have been saying. There's an entire generation of kids that have been trained on Chromebooks. And so in the same way that our generation was trained on Apple IIe's, and
right.
That didn't work out for Apple the first time, but maybe it'll work out for Google or whoever this time. Yeah, Brett.
So I feel like I used Android for a little while, and the biggest downside, and it seems that it continues today, is the lack of OS software updates. And I think that's a huge factor in what allowed me to use my iPhone 7 for 4 years, is I've been getting consistent software updates. Mm-hmm. And so, like, in some senses, it might be better, like Peter was saying, like having the latest hardware does give you advantages. And so if you want the latest software, you are kind of forced to get the latest hardware. So it's kind of a weird way of thinking about it, but it could be an advantage for the Android ecosystem. But I'm just wondering, like, what you guys might think the factors are there. Why does this continue to be a problem for Android so many years later that they can't keep their phones getting software updates?
Well, but then that was also what the whole Pixel was supposed to nudge people in the direction of doing, and it hasn't worked. It also was a way for Google to try to get a relationship with the carriers. And the, you know, back to what Chris was talking about, like the carriers don't seem to want the pixels. They're not pushing the pixels. If so, I don't know. Now I'm arguing myself back to let me.
It seems like Google has enough money, though. If they really wanted that relationship to happen, they could make it happen.
You
they
would
could incentivize
that.
The carriers to do that.
You would think that, although in the current environment, I don't know how heavy-handed they could be with that. Mike, I unmuted you because you had a question in the chat from a while ago. So if you have anything you'd like to add to this conversation, jump in.
Oh, sure. Well, Chris just mentioned like that. I thought that was point was interesting about like using apps and not going through the app store. But I was just like curious about how that fits in the context of this discussion. Like maybe LiDAR is a better way of identifying who you are, but like in principle, you could do that interaction with the tech that exists now. So what is it about the new phone that makes that more appealing?
Chris, yeah, because I'm not sure.
Okay, let me try to like parse that a little bit, or maybe rephrase some of the things that I was saying. You know, one thing that is interesting in this question about, well, I'm sorry, I'm going to like jump around a little bit, but there is an interesting like sequence or period of time that Apple bakes into the products that you buy. So it's interesting, like, you know, unlike Tesla, like when you buy a phone from Apple, like you actually own it, unless you're, well, let's just go with that, right? And it gives you a certain number of years of, you know, performance and use. And then even a couple, well, recently, obviously, we find that after a couple of years, the battery starts to like die off or whatever, and it's problematic. And then Apple basically just end of lifes their operating system updates for previous products, right? Like I have an iPad mini, and basically it's stuck at iOS 12. It's basically a piece of junk now. It doesn't do a bunch of the authentication things that I would expect it to do. And so those conveniences that are brought about by some of the security chips, you know, whether it's Apple Silicon or not, that are part of the newer devices that encourage you to sort of decide that the inconvenience of, you know, the thumb press or whatever, the Touch ID, you know, is worth the upgrade or something. It just sort of like grates on you. I think what I was saying about like LiDAR and authentication and continuous authentication and stuff like that in new devices is that there is actually a lot of machine learning that goes into deciding whether a person is likely to be who they say they are and whether they're likely to be a real person. And that the capabilities of modern processors are such that they need to be very performant, very efficient with power, and yet constantly calculating the likelihood that you are who you say you are. And I can say this because having worked at Uber, one of their, you know, biggest cost centers, at least when I was there back in 2016, you know, was fraud from the thousands and thousands of devices that people would buy in China and attach to dogs to sort of walk around neighborhoods to basically, you know, get fares. And if we are able to move to a world where authentication just sort of happens and you get access to everything in the App Store sort of for your one low price for your Apple subscription on an annualized basis, that becomes very interesting and very compelling. That specific thing is probably not going to happen, but it should start to open our eyes to the possibility of what it means to live in like the Apple universe in a very deep, like committed way.
Well, and also on a fundamental level, remember there was that fad, it was a decade ago now or something, for the idea that maybe what will happen is that the smartphone will get so smart that it'll be the thing that we inject into the computer. There was at a CES one year where there were all these computers where it's like you put it in the dock and then you use your phone as the computer. That's not never happened, but it's almost this where the phone does become sort of not just the key card. And
well, it unlocks so much, right?
Not the mothership of your entire digital daily life, but maybe closer to the key card.
Well, it's sort of tethered, and then it's sort of like phones home to the server and make sure things are still good. And again, it's already becoming your key card. Your key card? No, your car key. Your car key, right? So there are elements of that where we're starting to live inside of an authenticated, secure enclave. And that is opening up new types of experiences on these devices, specifically payments and access to services.
I want to wrap up phones after this last question, but Peter, go ahead and make your comment because this is coming back to now how much longer will Google do Android, but this is a good point too.
So yeah.
Not Android, but hardware. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess just to add on to my previous question about Google giving up on Pixel, I also feel like they're signaling that they're not caring about the Android ecosystem when they haven't really made a good competitor to the iPad, whether that's hardware or Android tablet OS. I'm wondering.
But they're not alone in that, because that's continues to be one of the more mysterious things to me, is the tablet somehow continues to be essentially an Apple-only category. I mean, I know that probably if you look at volume, maybe the Amazon version of the forked Android tablets maybe has sold a shit ton. But, you know, how far into the iPad era are we? And there is no, at least Android is a Pepsi to iOS Coke. There is absolutely nobody that is even within striking. No one even, so I wouldn't blame Google for that. Like, no one, even Samsung, anybody is like, there's no, you don't see tablets out there that are not iPads.
That doesn't start from Android basically just making their iPad-like interface just blown up Android apps.
Yeah, but then that gets into
the developer tools.
The whole, that does get into the, well, so then now this is making your point. That does get into the whole fracturing of the Android ecosystem, and thus the original argument for Google doing hardware so that they would all. So, right, you've made your point.
I want to just like return to some core assumptions about this marketplace, because Apple and Coke, you know, Coke and Pepsi are basically like serving the same job to be done, which I'm not sure what that job is. It's horrible for humanity, but regardless, like, they're both liquid form of a sugary beverage. Great. In the case of Apple and Google, I think it's so important to take the analysis of what each of their business models is, right? Apple is a jewelry manufacturer, you know, that makes products that are connected to the internet, and Google and Facebook are advertising companies that make money by selling your attention to other people. Mm-hmm. So why would they bother spending money creating an amazing tablet when the whole iPad concept is around creativity and brilliance and about expressivity? And I mean, if you think about even like the fumble that Microsoft made when they basically built their first tablet or something, and it essentially took a mouse-based interface and just threw it onto a screen and removed the keyboard. It was like you totally missed the point. But that's because you're in an operating system, a Microsoft Office paradigm of a business model. And so you don't really care if people can't, you know, do brilliant things and write things with a pencil that like looks beautiful. Right.
And by the way, as someone that still regularly buys digital ad campaigns, we always tell every time we have our agency do a buy, like, we don't want to buy on tablets. Right.
Mm, yeah, so again, exactly.
Why would
Google invest in that?
You never get a decent ROI on it. Everybody in advertising knows that. And so, right.
So basically, it's a way to keep you in the Apple ecosystem. It provides you a great tool for kids to watch TV on, or movies, or whatever, you know, Disney Plus, Apple bundle,
YouTube,
whatever it is.
Which is owned by Google.
Fair. That's probably the one case where there are ads. And since Apple's never going to do video ads like that, then that's an interesting, maybe it drives adoption. Actually, that's a good point. So for parents, and I don't want to speak for parents because I'm not one, but I know some, and I had some, like, the iPad provides a great viewing device or a pacifier for children, and Google provides free content for it. If you want to get content from the Apple universe or the Disney universe, you're going to pay a lot more, and children are very expensive. So basically, Google is sort of supplementing the rearing of children through iPads.
We're going to jump off the phones here, because there's a couple of other things that I want to, Stuart, I'm asking you to unmute. I feel like, I even had this argument with the Tech Meme editors this week that Visa and Plaid story was not getting enough attention. And I tried to make the case for why it should get more attention. Stuart, what do you think about that?
I think DOJ seems to be stepping up and saying this is a problem, and they know they're going to have problems downstream. They are trying. What was the comment you made today? Taking them out right before they blossom?
Well, it's more the argument that I read between the lines of what the DOJ was saying was that essentially we have this whole fintech sector that is exploding and blossoming. And the whole idea is we're trying to have these new companies disrupt the credit card companies and the banks and cut down the fees and whatever. So
what
I recognized was that they recognized for the first time, oh, we can't allow, right when this whole new sector starts to flower, the incumbents to do what the tech platforms have done for the last 20 years, which is immediately incorporate those innovations into their utility belts so that they essentially absorb all of the innovation. We want to try to allow the market to do the innovation for us. And so like, that's the point that people like Tim Wu and others have been making for years. And I'm just saying that I saw them recognize that for the first time. Now they're talking about it specifically in this space of fintech. They don't want fintech to die before it can do its full flowering and let the chips fall where they may. They are essentially saying, we want to see this play out more before it gets put on ice. And I'm saying that everyone in tech should recognize that, because it's fintech right now, but it can be any space going forward. Especially if we are going to have a Democratic administration for at least 4 years, I would expect that to happen a ton and in every sector.
70s and 80s, it was oil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And them doing the same thing. You were solar, you were wind, you got swallowed up. You had something interesting, you got swallowed up. Cisco did it for years, right? You had something that was competitive with their offering. They absorbed you and found a way to pay it out.
One of the reasons why we have this issue where the U.S. can't create its own telecoms network anymore is because you had so much absorption and stuff like that, that then when certain big players got out-innovated and essentially went bankrupt, and I'm thinking of Nortel, which isn't a U.S. company, but like, you know, Canadian. But the point being made here is that because you allowed a certain sector, specifically telecoms networking, to so conglomerize that when the true innovation came from overseas, which the government couldn't, you know, there wasn't enough nimbleness because the market had become so ossified into two or three players.
Yep.
And so that's another argument again. And speaking of China, you also were asking me about TikTok and whatever happened with that. And let me tell you something.
It was getting shut down, and now it's everywhere, and everybody's great with it.
And literally, that was a month ago that it looked like it was going to happen. It was going to be shut down in 24 hours.
Right.
So, I mean, look, and you guys here, I tried to bend over backwards not to be political, but I'm going to be political in this sense, because in just the business sense, it seems to me that the people in the U.S. government that were making all of this hay about TikTok were only doing it to score points, and that's it. And when the utility of like looking tough on China kind of petered out, they don't care. And so unless someone can give me a better argument, it looks 100% like all smoke and mirrors to me.
And do we think it's going to be any different with Google?
For the DOJ case?
Yeah. Granted, they're two very different worlds, Chris, but was the government really ready to make their best case against Google? You don't think that he had them push the edge and bring that up way earlier than they were ready to make their play?
From what I read, what I listened to and so on, I think that they were close, and I feel like, and actually, I don't know if this is Brian's assessment or someone else's, but the case, as I understand it, against Google is very narrow and about a specific type of exploitation that could actually be successful. And so the more narrow it is and the more mm-hmm. exploitation they can show, then the more likely that they might actually have some sort of resolution where an action can actually occur. Now, it still will take lots of time, but if you try to go after them with all the kind of insane stuff that like right-wing people think about, like censorship and so on these media platforms, which, you know, doesn't really seem to be happening, then that becomes, I think, much harder to prove and to demonstrate harm, in which case that could just go on forever and the case just gets dismissed, right? Whereas focusing on a very, very small sliver of Google's business is more likely, I think, to be an effective outcome. When it comes to the TikTok case, what I'm wondering is if, first of all, these things are very complex and very challenging. I think, like, I don't know, my assessment, given the way I understand the hopefully previous president, was he needs very simple ideas that go well on, like, Fox News. And so you associate COVID with China, TikTok with China, and you just say, shut it down, and boom, you're done. And what you sort of forget is this is sort of a globally innovative company that's produced some competition to Instagram and others. And essentially, if you shut it down, you're actually stifling the very free speech that you say these platforms are like not only a cell phone, but it's sort of like shooting your left foot. And then suddenly, you know, you're startled. And so you shoot your right foot too. Like, I just don't. So they kind of like just, and they were playing a game of soccer. So, you know what? It's like game over.
Can I say this though? I would not be surprised at all to that end. I would not be surprised at all if, again, assuming, 6 months into a Biden administration, we didn't see this revisited where they're trying to do something about TikTok. But as you're alluding to, Chris, maybe they do it in a smarter way. Because my understanding is that there are very serious concerns inside the apparatus or the community that is the national security infrastructure. And they were the ones that were initially pushing hard for this because they feel that it is insecure. And they're the ones that were behind the whole, you know, get all the Huawei stuff out of the telecom stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is revisited, because those same people are going to be inside a Biden administration. And if they can just, you know, get whisper in the ears of people that can say something more coherently and do another argument more coherently, I wouldn't be surprised at all if this is revisited. I don't know that they could, you know, do something so far as force a sale, but something could come back on this.
So like, one of the things that I would like put to this group and in general is sort of, what is the world that we imagine we'd be living in 4 to 5 years, if any of the remedies that no one has defined yet, but let's say they magically occurred, have happened. So we're 5 years in the future and TikTok has been shut down. Okay. So what does that media landscape look like, and what has actually been solved? Have we actually solved the problem of deepfakes or media manipulation? Is the population any more inoculated against disinformation and information that's coming from Parler or like whatever other platforms may exist out there? Like, ultimately, it seems like we're trying to solve problems that are of the industrial era, but they make no sense in the internet era. And so I've been trying to sort of think more about us being in the middle of an information war that probably started 10 years ago, but, you know, was the, you know, there was Skunk Works or something like that. And we are seeing like the consequences of it. And we are seeing the language weaponized in such a way that we're kind of not actually really realizing like what we're talking about. So when it comes to like the idea of like breaking up Google, we could, I mean, there's a theory that, you know, maybe that would oxygenate the market, so to speak, to provide more players the ability to compete and so on and so forth. But I don't know that we've thought about what the marketplace should actually look like in a world where, in order for many of these things to work, one, again, users have to be authenticated. You have to know who the user is. If you're going to ban them from one platform, can they just go to any other platform? Is the ability to create infinite numbers of accounts or bot accounts or fake accounts or whatever, should that be enshrined in the Constitution? Is that part of the exercise of privacy? What is free speech in these environments when, one, you can weaponize it, and two, I can basically take my free speech, multiply it by a million bot accounts, and then have them all follow each other, and then simulate something that doesn't, like, this has never happened before. This has never existed before. And so we're taking Civil War era type approaches to solving these problems that I just don't think make sense.
So you don't think when they shut down Silk Road, it solved that whole problem of illicit buying in the dark web?
Oh, my desire for illicit drugs after Silk Road shut down was totally gone.
Right. Perfect, yeah. That's the old.
It killed my demand altogether, for sure.
The whole old whack-a-mole situation, like in terms of piracy and crime and stuff like that. One thing that I would say though is that, yes, I agree with you, Chris, that like, just breaking things up without having an idea of what that would do to the marketplace and how the marketplace would reform and what sort of way you'd want it to reform it into is short-sighted, except for the fact that on a base level, the argument could be made that you have an ossified marketplace with 4 or 5 oligarchs at the top, and any sort of stirring up of the pot is healthy to a pot that is stagnated. Now,
we don't know that. It's a good idea. You know,
the countervailing argument is sort of the historical one of breaking up AT&T, and that goes both ways, because we know that you broke up AT&T, you had all of these baby bells. There was like a dozen of them at one point, and they all essentially reformed into AT&T, with Verizon being the lone baby bell that grew into its own behemoth. But what did happen during that whole 25-year period, you had a brief flowering that allowed the cellular and mobile markets to develop. As opposed to the classic example is that we didn't have, we could have had answering machines 25 years before we did, but because we only had one company that refused to give us the technology, we never got it. And so there is an argument to be made that I'm not saying that the cellular and mobile revolution wouldn't have happened had you not broken up AT&T, but because serendipitously you did right at the time that this market was coming, the technology was coming, it allowed innovation to flower for a period of time. Great. But then at the same time, the argument against this sort of stuff is governments and politics on a timeline that big, you're going to have Republican and then Democrat and then Republican. So there's no coherent strategy over the course of time it would require for you to create the sort of market change that you would want to actually happen, because it's so schizophrenic from one administration to the other. But all right.
Well, so, but one thing that, to add to that, sorry, just like,
yeah,
because it occurs to me that the post office like exists and it's existed for a long time. And regardless of its current performance, it has lasted, blue and red and whoever else ideological, differences, because it's a basic fundamental service. And in a similar way, it feels like, I don't know that social media is quite the same, but there is a sort of notion of a common carrier where the point about interop does become more interesting. So, you know, when I was working on decentralizing social networks back in 2006 through 10, like the thought was like, if I'm a Twitter user and you're a Facebook user, why can't we sort of subscribe to each other's feeds? Or why can't we, be friends across platforms and networks? And mm-hmm. from a competitive perspective, I think this is why I struggle with the notion of bringing like the AT&T, let's break them up concept to this paradigm, where really what you want is the ability, if you're a Verizon customer and I'm an AT&T customer, for us to call each other. So if there were the ability to interop to that level, maybe that would lead to some sort of new entrance, for smaller players, right, where they're little, saplings or whatever growing up, that would allow for new types of things to happen. So if the platforms were more open in that respect, granted there's problems with spam and abuse and all these other things, but let's say you solve for identity, then maybe that would be a different approach that's more about building sort of an interconnected rail system in the country than saying, let's have a bunch of different companies where you basically now as a user have to have accounts on all of them and you don't know where your friends are anymore. And it's like a completely, it's a clusterfuck in terms of where knowing where your data is.
What do you call an endpoint security product that works perfectly but makes users miserable? You call it a failure. The old approach to endpoint security is to lock down employee devices and roll out changes through forced restarts, but it just doesn't work. IT is miserable because they've got a mountain of support tickets, employees start using personal devices just to get their work done, and executives opt out the first time it makes them late for a meeting. You can't have a successful security implementation unless you work with end users. That's where Collide comes in. Their user-first device trust solution notifies users as soon as it detects an issue in their device and teaches them how to solve it without needing help from IT. That way, untrusted devices are blocked from authenticating, but users don't stay blocked. Collide is designed for companies with Okta, and it works on macOS, Windows, Linux, and mobile devices. So if you have Okta and you're looking for a device trust solution that respects your team, visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride. In 2023, just 10 vulnerabilities accounted for over half of the incidents responded to by Arctic Wolf's incident response. Wouldn't you like to know how to take them off the table and make life more difficult for cybercriminals? That's just one of the essential insights you'll find inside the Arctic Wolf Lab's 2024 Threats Report. Authored by their elite team of security researchers, data scientists, and security development engineers, and backed by the data gained from trillions of weekly observations with thousands of unique environments, this report offers expert analysis into attack types, root causes, top vulnerabilities, TTPs, and more. Discover the attack vector behind nearly half of all successful cybercrimes, why ransom demands climbed 20% from 2023, and find out why 2024 will be an especially volatile year for cybersecurity. Learn more and get your copy now at arcticwolf.com/techmeme. That's arcticwolf.com/techmeme.
Rachel, jump in here real quick, because this is coming back to the idea of politics muting people and things like that. But your question in the chat is something that I've been thinking a lot about lately. So go ahead and ask it. And then I bet Chris has a lot to say about this.
Oh, well, I mean, unfortunately, my feeling has just been, being here in DC and being a kind of longtime policy wonk and also just early tech adopter. I was on social media way back in the day, and it was totally different. But we've all seen the place that we're coming to, right? Like, on some levels, it's just the same as what happened with regular print media and stuff, traditional media. And I am concerned that, but because of the technology and how quickly you can have someone like President Trump saying, oh, this is BS, and yes, it's great that Twitter labels it, but I mean, Parler has been growing so rapidly. And then there was that whole deal with Discord and blah, blah, blah. I am just afraid that, the filter bubble is just going to get worse. If you, to what you're saying, if there's not an integrated framework, I just see us splintering off into these different sides, and just this divide that is kind of killing us right now is
right.
Just getting worse.
So what you said in the chat is that's right along the lines of what I've been thinking about lately is, will we just have a left internet and a right internet? And the funny thing is, and this is what I've been thinking about lately, is, there's been all this back and forth about, tweets being taken down, accounts being shut down and stuff like that. But what that really has shown us is that for all of this talk of, there's media bubbles, there's two sides, we've all been playing on the same platforms, and that's why this is happening, right? Like, there hasn't been a right Twitter and a left Twitter. It's starting to happen with things like Parler. By the way, is it pronounced Parler, not Parlay? I mean,
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Actually. Okay. I don't know. Or Gab. I think. Whatever.
I think the French is. Yeah.
I was gonna say
it's not very French.
Parlay.
From
Parlay.
Appalachia, where I'm from,
Yeah, but Parlay makes more sense if you're talking about talking. But anyway, but so the point that I'm
like, if you're a pirate.
Right. The point that I'm making is that it's. People have missed the point, even though that Facebook is maybe more generous to right wing, but everyone's still on these same platforms. And I'm wondering if that's about to end. The reason we're having these fights is because everyone is on Twitter, where everyone is still on Facebook, everyone is on Instagram. But if you get this splintering where, no one from red states goes to Instagram because they think it's a left platform, or they all abandon Twitter and create their own Twitters, and no one on the left goes to Facebook because they think all it does is enrage their fathers and grandfathers and whatever. So that maybe we might look back on this a few years from now and be like, yeah, but at least during the Trump era, we were all arguing in the same place.
Same cesspool.
Yeah. But I mean, there's value to that, being in the same place where we can all hear each other. And that gets into the idea of, like, how could you have a country, if people are saying now you have a country where people have different realities from one another, where citizens have fundamentally different views of what reality is. Well, imagine if there's an entire ecosystem that never overlaps at all. And so you don't know what is enraging your neighbor or your neighbor cares about, because you can't even see the outrage. At least we can see the outrage now.
I have thoughts. If anyone else wants to jump in, though.
All right, but just I don't want to end on this one. So do it short. Do it short and brilliant and succinct and solve it in 2 minutes.
I'll do my best. Obviously, like this sort of just bringing the concepts of terrestrial geography to the internet feels like the wrong direction to go in. However, one of the reasons why we are so polarized and why we believe there's a right and a left, way to do things seems to be because we think that there has to be one true way of solving problems. If this election and the resulting red-blue map that you see says anything, it's actually that the solutions that are needed across the United States are much more specific and like they are geographic and regional, such that if you are living in a rural community, then conservatism probably serves you well. Whereas if you're living in an urban environment, then more liberalism, because you're running up against all these people who are unlike you and are different from you, and it's more of a diverse community. So therefore, it is necessary just to live to be more inclusive in the way that you approach the world. Then I think it's useful then to think about the structure of society and culture in those places, and then to deliver very specifically personalized and customized solutions to those different areas. So in other words, if we are arguing about things at the national level, and we're saying there's one way to do things, and either you're super woke or you're unwoke or whatever, that actually ignores the general cultural evolution that we're going through. But we're having that conversation all in the same place, all at the same tenor, without being able to have any compassion or empathy for how other people are actually sorting out how to live their lives. And I think that that's the problem, is that we're having arguments about things that make no fucking difference to us individually. And we seem like we're so sure of it because in our own little world, we are sure of it and we are probably right. And so that separation is, I think, the thing that needs to be represented in our politics. It's just actually what happens on the coasts and in the places where there's schools and where there's lots of people coming and going. They can have a different set of rules and ways of being that are different from other places in the world. And that's not wrong.
Rachel, another brilliant one playing off of what Chris tipped on urban versus rural. In a scenario where maybe at least for tech workers, we can work wherever we want. I mean, show of hands, maybe I should ask this on the show. If you didn't have to live in a city and you could do your tech job from a mountain top somewhere, would you go? Rachel, go ahead.
Yes. So I'm in this weird position. I'm originally from this teeny tiny town in rural Appalachia. You know, my grandfather worked for the mail service, was a rural mail carrier for 40 years, retired with something like 5 years worth of sick days and vacation he hadn't taken because he was just so damn glad to not be working in the mines. And I see this terrible, I've lived in DC for 20 years. I consider myself a kind of urban person, but at the same time, I think sometimes people in urban areas don't appreciate that, you know, at some point in your life, you were sitting here typing away on your laptop and it was probably fueled by some coal, which was fueled by some miners that, you know, are now back there dying of black lung. And there was not reinvestment into the area, into a lot of these areas that are the fucking, excuse my language, the flyover countries, the areas that we're seeing are going for Trump. And when you have poor education, poorly funded education, and these, it's all cyclical. So I'm really upset about how we've handled COVID. I'm also really upset about how my landlord is refused to go down even $75 on my rent in downtown DC. And so I had this crazy idea to, this might be the one time in our history where I can maybe say to people like you all, come to this beautiful place that I'm from. The rents are so much cheaper. Maybe if we actually interacted together in a real way versus possibly spinning off into these alternative social media universes, we could better appreciate where people are coming from. And I don't know what I think about cities and the future of cities. I personally want to return to DC, but I can see a lot of people maybe coming to a place like where I'm from, getting out on a kayak and saying, wow, that's pretty cool. Like, yeah. Why was I paying that much to live in San Francisco?
Or
wherever.
The thing that I, like, uniformly, all of my friends that live in San Francisco are the people that are insane bikers, hikers. They love San Francisco because they can live in a city, but there's mountains, like, and you know, an hour or two away. And so I'm I'm just wondering if a trend is not necessarily just chasing the cheaper rent. It's just that, you know, not everyone is made for city living. JCPenney's, I've almost had you ask a question a couple of times now. You're in Kansas right now. Like, if I could come to Kansas, but maybe there's not mountains, but, you know, there's probably a lot more outdoors activities than are easy for me to get to in New York City.
Yes, sir. That's totally correct. And I lived in Denver, downtown Denver, worked downtown Denver for 3 years. And I feel like I kind of just got priced out. I have a college degree, but, you know, I don't know. I couldn't translate that into a better paying gig. And, you know, after 3 years, I eventually had to come home here to Western Kansas. But I hear what you're saying. You know, a lot of people live, you know, San Francisco, Denver, because like the mountains and the outdoor recreation is close, you know, and there may not be mountains in Western Kansas, but we've got, you know, lakes, hunting.
Yeah. Hunting,
stuff
fishing.
People like it,
but. Yeah, right. What I'm saying is it's weird that tech people seem to self-select. Like the tech people here in New York City are the people that are in the yoga classes and the CrossFit classes. And I'm not saying those don't exist in San Francisco, but man, my San Francisco people, Chris, you're a Bay Area person. You love your outdoor stuff. And so, right. Like, you know, like I've been talking to what if we moved to Vermont? You know, it's not that far away from a big city and like we could live out in the woods somewhere, you know?
I mean, I think like one addition to this is, again, thinking about what will be common, I don't know if it's like services or just a standard of living that is necessary in all these different environments. And I say that because, you know, me and my partner have also been talking about where we might, you know, move or live or whatever. And one of the benefits of living in Oakland is one, I have pretty good network connectivity. And I know that like in some places, based on the quality of the Zoom calls that I have, like that is not true everywhere else. And second, that sometimes my Amazon orders, which say they're going to arrive in 7 days, come in 5 days because I'm so close to the port. So I guess my question is, to what degree are we able to, I guess, kind of lateralize or spread some of the benefits that technology has brought in terms of new types of services that are more responsive, more personalized, more on demand than what I think used to be the assumption about living in more like rural places or less urban places, that you just wouldn't have access to the same level of service. It seems like that's becoming more the case. Like I don't watch too much TV, but I see ads from time to time on Hulu, and I see more and more of them for Postmates and for Walmart and things like that. And I'm wondering if those companies are able to bring more of that to more of the country or more of the world, then maybe that does provide more choices, which then allows there to be more of that interaction that Rachel's talking about.
Because we've just hit an hour, I'm about to wrap it up. The very first question was from Thomas. I don't see Thomas on there, but I wish he was, if he was somehow there, because I would love to have delved into what he was exactly asking. But the question in chat was, what happens with IP when a startup closes, especially when it's been VC funded? And Chris, you can speak to this too, but the answer is that, you know, IP gets bought all the time. Even when you sell a company for parts, that's often the only parts that people care about. I've actually never sold a startup in my life, but I have sold IP from startups that I've created, and I got more money for that IP than, you know, probably the company was worth. So essentially the deal was, yeah, go ahead and wind yourself down, but before you do, we'll cut you a check for that stuff. So that sort of stuff happens all the time, but I'd love to know if there was a deeper question or vein that he was trying to get into for that. But right, Chris, like often with startups, the idea is the only thing because we don't have factories anymore. And like, it's often the only thing that matters, right?
I mean, it's hard.
It's the people and the idea. Those are the two most valuable things in modern companies. Yeah.
But I also think maybe this is harder to quantify to some degree because switching costs are relatively quite low, but it is also the relationships that you develop over the course of offering the service, right? So I feel like one of Facebook's biggest powers is the relationship that it has with its customers over a period of time,
right,
and all that it knows about you, right? I mean, there are a number of new social networks that start up all the time, but the amount of friction and energy that you have to put in to get to a similar place in terms of personalization or content or seeing your friend, like it'll be interesting to see what, I think it's, is it Telegraph or whatever that new social network is that's sort of, you know, all about being nice or something, like how they do, because I guess what I'm saying from a startup perspective is that one of the values that you do create is in the relationships that you have with your customers. IP certainly is one, but it's not the only.
Well, and if the question was, do the VCs get that IP? No, they do not, because they're not in the business of holding IP for any period of time. The what let's end with is one of the questions that came up in the subreddit, which was, where does the phrase something something before leading into some topic mean? So, which, so Chris, I think you said it is such a classic Brianism, where I'll say something something modern startup life or whatever. And I tried to Google around on that before. If someone in here knows what the answer is, I don't. I think that it's just a version of yada yada that I've been hearing a lot lately, where it's like A, B, C, D, yada, yada, F, you know, like, or the thing that I saw was, and this is probably would have stuck in my head. There's the Simpsons Halloween Horror episode where they do the Shining parody. There's that classic line where Homer says, no TV and no beer makes Homer something, something. I don't think that that's what did it, because it's in the reverse order for that to make sense in the sentence. But, yeah, I don't know where that came from, and I saw an Urban Dictionary thing on that that was more about, like, oh, something, something is, you know, that's sex or, you know, drugs or something, but I think it's just yada, yada.
it's like the equivalent of, like, the ellipses, you know, it's like, it's the Brian equivalent of three periods.
Right.
Something, 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 like, it's really trying to, like, jog your memory, and you're like, yeah, 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 whatever, whatever.
Right, right. It's just, like, all of the, it's more, I guess what I'm functionally doing is, all of the things that I could run down that would be like, I'm reminding you that I made this point. I'm reminding you we talked about this. But yeah, something, something, it's the time for something, something. Does anyone remember what happened to the whole TikTok thing? Right, yeah. It's just like, I want to break down the whole, oh my God, we talked about this mess a million times, but here it is again in a different thing. Anyway, thank y'all for showing up for this great conversation. I'll put this out tomorrow at the usual time and appreciate it. And when we do this again, all y'all come back and give us your two cents again.